A bit of history. At its outset, the march into World War I looked often like a celebration. In capital cities throughout Europe, crowds poured into the streets, waving flags and singing their national anthems. Swept into this patriotic tide, soldiers mustered in their millions and prepared for war by sharpening swords, cleaning pistols, polishing boots, and readying saddlebags for their cavalry horses. Flowers garlanded their paths to trains and ships, and words such as honour and glory were spoken with reverence. On June 28, 1914, Serbian nationalists had assassinated Austrian Archduke Franz Ferdinand in Sarajevo. Although the murder lit the fuse of war, any number of acts could have stamped out the spark before the explosion. But hapless diplomats and the leaders they served failed to do so. Indeed, many never tried, giving in to the suggestions of battle-hungry generals. Hastening the disaster was an assembly of ossified empires, tangled alliances, inflexible war plans, massive standing armies, and the views of Germany, most prominently those of Kaiser Wilhelm II, that their country must choose world power or downfall. Germany intended a swift march of its armies west through Belgium, followed by a broad sweep south to envelop Paris. This decisive thrust would allow them to focus their attention on defeating Russia in the east. They made quick early progress. Their huge artillery took but hours to level Belgian forts that had stood for centuries. To forestall future local resistance, they torched villages and executed their inhabitants. It was the first shiver of the horrors to follow. The British and French slowed the German advance on Paris, then pushed it back. A series of flanking offensives and counter-offensives ensued. In the east, the Russians threw themselves against German and Austro-Hungarian troops with force. As armies of a scale never seen before engaged one another, marshalling the new technologies of rifles, machine guns, high-explosive shells, and even poison gas, deaths mounted at an alarming rate. Many believed it would be over by Christmas. But by winter, any hope of a swift victory was lost. Hundreds of thousands were already dead on both sides, and the murder mill of the trenches had begun. Now the struggle became what some predicted it always would be, a war of attrition and annihilation that enveloped countries around the globe. Those captured by the enemy suffered their own brand of hell. "Those vanquished in war are held to belong to the victor," stated Aristotle, and indeed for most of the history of warfare, death or enslavement awaited anyone captured on the battlefield. Often their families suffered the same, their towns razed too. Brutality was strength, mercy weakness. With the rise of professional armies in the 18th century, though, internment and POW, prisoner of war, exchanges became more standard. In the Seven Years' War, the French King Louis XV instructed his officers to treat the vanquished British like your own. Nonetheless, the British and French, particularly during the Napoleonic age, ran a race to the bottom in their handling of the captured, many of whom were interned in the dark, sodden underbellies of moored ships, or hulks. Many American soldiers in the Revolutionary War died in hulks outside New York City, sinkholes of filth, vermin, infectious disease, and despair, after being taken prisoner by the British. Abraham Lincoln made a marked leap forward by codifying some principles of prisoner treatment in an army field manual, not the least of which stated that POWs should be given the basic needs of shelter, food, clothing, and medical attention. Then, in 1899, and again in 1907, delegations from across the globe gathered in The Hague, the Netherlands, to civilize war. Beyond stipulations on diplomacy, naval warfare, and restrictions over the use of poisonous gases and hollow-point bullets, the two international conferences set out clear rules about the treatment of prisoners. It was forbidden to kill or wound an enemy combatant who had surrendered his arms or who could not defend himself. Prisoners must be humanely treated on the same footing as the troops of the government who captured them. Enlisted soldiers, but not officers, could be used for labour, but the tasks were not to be excessive nor related to the war. Relief.